Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the story of the redemption of humankind, how God sent His Son to free us all from sin and get us back safely to our home in heaven. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain of the Carmelite Monastery, just south of Terre Haute at the entrance of Allendale, and chaplain of Jean Paul II Catholic High at 12 Points in Terre Haute, Indiana. Our guest again, who's prepared this wonderful series, is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at Jean Paul II Catholic High for over 11 years. And Ron, we're in the series right now where we're up to the life of Jesus, and he's been selecting his 12 apostles. And we just finished section where he selected Peter, James, and John. And the next question, I guess, would be, did he pick up some more disciples or apostles in Bethsaida?
It's true, he did pick up Peter and John, and it was Andrew. But perhaps James, the Bible doesn't mention James, but since James was Peter's brother, you would have to think that it was about that time that James also became one of his disciples. But when they went to Bethsaida, which was about 100 miles north up the Jordan River, right on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee, where Peter and all of them lived, Jesus picks up some more disciples there. One of them, of course, was Philip, who happened to live in Bethsaida, the same town that Peter and Andrew lived, and James and John. Perhaps Jesus met John's brother James at this time, as I mentioned a while ago. But the Bible doesn't mention this. Philip, in turn, introduced Jesus to his friend Nathanael, who was from Cana. At first, Nathanael refused to acknowledge the claims of Jesus because he was from that obscure town of Nazareth. This doubt vanished when Christ manifested knowledge of the secrets of his heart. This story, of course, is told by John himself in his first chapter.
Ron, the name Nathanael doesn't appear in the gospel list of the apostles. What can you tell us about that? It's always a little confusing.
Yes, the Dictionary of the Bible says that Nathanael was probably one of the 12, since he is a member of the group of apostles to whom Christ appeared after his resurrection. Usually, he is identified with Philip's friend Bartholomew, who is mentioned as an apostle in the gospel list. So it's probable that Nathanael is Bartholomew.
Okay, and that's a pretty good educated guess. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, next, the first miracle of Jesus, the wedding feast at Cana. What happened after visiting Bethsaida and acquiring some of his disciples?
Well, after visiting Bethsaida and acquiring additional disciples, the party of five, maybe six, depends on whether James had joined them at that time, they set out for Cana, which was a small town near Nazareth, to attend a wedding. This was probably sometime in February of 28 AD. At the time when the Jews under Joshua were conquering the Promised Land, Cana was one of the villages that belonged to the territory inhabited by the Canaanites. When the Jews divided their new land by lot, this is, you know, hundreds of years before that, it became the portion that fell to the tribe of Zebulun. Cana of Galilee was and is located on the way between Nazareth and Sepphoris. And Flavius Josephus, the historian, wrote that Cana was located between Sepphoris and Tiberias, which was on the eastern or on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. So Cana was not too far from Nazareth, only, you know, 5 or 6 miles, if that far. And then Sepphoris was just 4 or 5 miles from Nazareth. So they were all in Galilee, not too far apart.
Okay, before we go on to this important story of the wedding feast at Cana, tell us a little about Sepphoris, because I don't think most of us know much about that at all.
Yeah, and that's kind of a mystery, because it was a very important city at the time. In fact, it was the most important city in Galilee, next to Tiberias. Josephus, he calls Sepphoris the ornament of Galilee. The Romans had made it their Galilean capital in 55 B.C. And in 47 B.C., Herod the Great made it his Galilean capital. And after Herod died in 4 B.C., his son and successor, Herod Antipas, chose this site as his capital. So, you know, it's mysterious that we don't hear about Sepphoris in the New Testament. The Romans had built a number of important roads that connected the city with other major cities in Galilee, such as the port city of Acre over on the Mediterranean to the west, and to Tiberias over on the Sea of Galilee to the east. This made the city more accessible for trade for the whole area and enabled the Romans to control the country better and move their forces faster in case of a revolt. So it was a pretty significant city. Josephus claims that Sepphoris was the largest city in Galilee and had an exceptionally strong fortress. As I said a while ago, it was only about 4 miles from Nazareth. Just about an hour, maybe an hour and a half walk. So it's strange. It's a mystery that it's not mentioned in the Gospels or in the Acts. But scholars have surmised that Joseph and Jesus probably found work there as carpenters. The city, Sepphoris, it wasn't destroyed by the Romans when the Jews revolted against them in 67 to 70 AD because they refused to participate in the rebellion. During the early 2nd century, the city was rebuilt and expanded in a grand Roman plan, and in the beginning of the 3rd century, it was ruled by Jews once again for a while and became for some time the seat of the Jewish Sanhedrin. The Mishnah, which was a 2nd century series of books of Jewish practices, was compiled at about 200 AD by Yehuda Hanasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, and who was happened to be a resident of the city for a period of 17 years. So Sepphoris was a very, very important city, far more important than in the time than Nazareth or Cana or any of those other cities in Galilee.
That is amazing. This is the first time in my life I've heard of Sepphoris. And you're describing it as the capital of Galilee and the like, and how that got missed in the New Testament and Jesus preaching and teaching is really a mystery. Well, let's go on. What about Tiberias? Obviously named after the great Roman general Tiberius.
And of course the emperor. Tiberias was founded in 18 AD on the western shore of the Lake of Genezareth, or the Sea of Galilee, by Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great. Herod Antipas was the ruler of Galilee from his father's death in 4 BC, as we've learned in some of the earlier sessions. And he ruled until his own death in 39 AD. He was appointed by Augustus Caesar as ruler of Galilee and Perea, which was on the east bank of the Jordan River. Herod Antipas made the new city his capital, and he named it after the Roman emperor, Tiberius Caesar. Later in 54 AD, the emperor Claudius added his own name to the city, calling it Tiberius Claudiopolis, or the city of Claudius. Jews refused to live in the city because it was found to have been built over an old cemetery, and they wouldn't live there until the graves were finally removed at some later date. And during the Jewish revolt against the Romans in 67 to 70 AD, the city was fortified to resist them. However, when the Romans finally came to the city itself, they opened the gates to Vespasian, who happened to be the general, later on becomes an emperor himself, and it was spared destruction. And after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the city became the virtual capital of the Jewish nation in the center of its cultural life. In fact, it became the seat of an important school of Jewish rabbis and scholars who made many important refinements on the Hebrew text of the Bible, as well as contributed to the composition of the Mishnah or the Talmud, which of course was commentary on the scriptures.
Well, so much for two of the big cities in Galilee, Sepphoris, whom most of us don't know anything, or didn't know anything about, and of course Tiberias, which probably most of us have heard of. Well, let's go on to this famous wedding feast at Cana, which almost anybody who's acquainted with the New Testament has heard about, Jesus attending the wedding with his newfound apostles, our disciples. But these specifically were his apostles, weren't they?
Yes, and Jesus, well, he was invited. So the couple to be married must have been a relative of Jesus, or at least certainly a very close friend, but probably a relative. And also his mother was there. Jewish weddings of the time lasted for several days and were accompanied by much eating, drinking, and merriment. And when the wine ran out, we all know this famous story, Mary said to Jesus that there was no wine. And he asked her of what business was this of his, and that his time had not yet come. Jesus was in effect telling his mother that if he performed a miracle now, he would be starting on the road to Calvary. In spite of this, Jesus did as his mother had asked and told the servants to fill six large stone jars, that's very important, stone jars with water, then draw some out and take it to the steward. Now, stone jars were used for the purpose of storing water for ritual purification in accordance with the purification commandments of the mitzvah, or the Jewish law, the Mosaic law. Because clay jars would have small pits where contamination could lodge. The steward tasted it and discovered that it was fine wine. In other words, Jesus had transformed it from water into wine. Then he took some to the bridegroom and told him, the steward did, told him that everyone else provides his guest with the best wine first, before they have drunk much. Then he puts out the cheap wine when they have drunk their fill. However, he was providing the best wine last. So actually, he just reversed the whole process of what most people would customarily have done, provided the best wine first and the cheap wine later. And he provided the cheap wine first and the best wine last.
That's a startling first miracle that Jesus works. I never heard, Ron, that explanation that why there were stone jars instead of clay jars, that the clay jars would have pits.
Must have been the finest wine ever ever in the history of the world.
Golly, yeah, I'm sure that was. Well, it was such an important occasion because it was the beginning of Jesus' public life and his first miracles when the apostles began to believe in him.
And if his mother almost forced him into it.
Right, and it's used so often about Mary's power with her son as an intercessor, and why we can go to Mary and ask her to ask Jesus for us. Well, to better fully understand what happened at the wedding, tell us a little more about the ancient Jewish wedding practices.
I believe that we need to look at this practice, this ancient Jewish wedding practices, to more fully understand the significance of many of Jesus' teachings. According to one source, when a young Jewish man wished to marry a young woman, it was customary for the prospective groom's father first to approach the girl's father at the young woman's home with a proposal of marriage that included a contract or covenant outlining the conditions for the marriage. The contract showed the young man's willingness to provide for the young woman and described the terms of the proposed marriage. The written contract listed the time, place, and size of the wedding, as well as recorded the dowry in terms of maintenance of the marriage. This binding document was kept in the bride's possession until the consummation of the marriage. It is until they were married and had intimate relations when they're talking about this term consummation. The bride price was the most important part of the contract. for it was the price that the young man was willing to pay to marry the young woman. This payment was to be made to the young woman's father in exchange for his permission to marry his daughter. The bride price was generally quite high because it compensated the young woman's family for the cost to raise a daughter, and also indicated the love that the young man had for the young woman. You see, in ancient societies, sons were usually considered to be more valuable than daughters, since they were physically more able to share the type of work that they did back in those days, farming and other heavy labor. If the bride price were agreeable to the young father's, to the young woman's father, the potential bride then entered the room, and the prospective groom proclaimed his love for her and asked her to be his bride. If she wished to be his wife, she accepted his proposal, and the agreement was validated by the prospective groom giving her a gift, which was usually a ring. Afterwards, the young man would pour her a glass of wine, and by drinking it, she showed her acceptance of his proposal. Now she and the young man were what was called betrothed, not engaged, but betrothed.
Okay, so wasn't the ancient ceremonial betrothal much more binding than what we consider an engagement today?
Yes, it certainly was. Our idea of the engagement is a testing time to ascertain the suitability of the prospective mates for marriage to one another. Also, it's a time to work out any areas of adjustment needed to assure the success of the marriage. You know, financial adjustments, in-law adjustments, all kinds of things.
No, we're talking about engagement.
Engagement,
today.
Yes, in our own society.
Okay.
It's not a binding contract, and it can be broken at any time for any reason. On the other hand, betrothal is in ancient Israel was legally binding, just like marriage. The only difference was that the marriage was not yet consummated. That is, the man and woman had not yet had intimate relations. This betrothal was considered so binding that the only way to break it was by an actual bill of divorcement. After assuring his bride that he would build a house or a home for her and that he would return to complete the marriage ceremony, the groom then he departed. And it usually took him from 1 to 2 years to build a new home, which was typically consisted of an addition built onto his father's house and then maybe a separate dwelling as well. A typical betrothal period was from 1 to 2 years, and during this time, the bride and bridegroom each would be preparing for the marriage, and they wouldn't see each other during that period of time.
Okay, that's pretty different than what we would call an engagement.
Now, if they did see each other, there wasn't anything against it. In fact, in the Mosaic Law, sometimes people even had intimate relations.
So because they were legally married.
Because they were basically legally married. So this is why, of course, when we talked about the story when Mary was became pregnant, her and Joseph were already betrothed. Of course, we know that it was a miraculous birth and conception and birth and all that kind of thing. But this sort of gives you a little bit of background of how what explains some of the aspects of that relationship between Mary and Joseph.
All right, what happened to the couple during this 1 or 2 year period of betrothal?
One source tells us that the bride was expected to remain true to her groom as she prepared herself and her trousseau, which would usually have included clothing, accessories, cosmetics, household linens, and utensil wares, things of that sort. Things that would help her, of course, to be a homemaker and a wife. She'd probably save much of her life to purchase these items. If she went out in public, she would wear a veil, so others would know that she was betrothed, so, because she was considered to be consecrated, set apart, or bought with a price. This source states that she lived for the day of his return for her, which would be heralded by a shout from the members of the wedding party. Another source states that, quote, before a couple chooses their wedding date, the bride would calculate very carefully when she expected to have her menstrual period. The wedding night should be scheduled so that the bride will have enough time to make an examination, that is, count 7 clean days, and go to the mikvah, that for a ritual purification bath in accordance with the law of Moses.
Okay, what about the bridegroom's preparation?
According to even another source, the bridegroom would prepare a wedding chamber or room for the honeymoon during the betrothal period. This was typically built onto the father's house in accordance with the father's specifications. It was supposed to be a beautiful place to bring the bride after the marriage ceremony. The young man would go for his bride only when his father approved. And after the marriage ceremony, the bride and groom were to spend 7 days there.
Well, what happened after the father gave his permission for his son to go and get his bride?
When the bridegroom's father deemed the wedding chamber ready, and maybe other preparations, he would tell his son that that all was ready and to go get his bride. According to one source, the bridegroom would abduct his bride secretly, like a thief at night, and take her to the wedding chamber. As soon as the members of the wedding spotted the moving torches signaling the groom's approach, their cry echoed through the streets, "The bridegroom is coming, the bridegroom is coming." As the bridegroom approached the bride's home, he would shout and blow the shofar, or the ram's horn, or a trumpet, so that she had some warning to gather her belongings to take, into the wedding chamber. The bridegroom and his friends would come into the bride's house, the bride's home, and get the bride and her bridesmaids. Although I read another source that says that the bride and his attendants came out to meet him, the bride and his attendants. The bride wouldn't know when her groom would come for her, so she always had to be ready. Since bridegrooms typically came for their brides in the middle of the night to steal them away, the bride would have to have her lamp and her belongings ready at all times. And upon hearing the announcement, the excited bride would drop everything in order to slip into her wedding dress and complete her final personal preparations. In other words, probably put on her makeup and her perfume and whatever else, her preparations for the marriage. And her sisters, or the bridesmaids, or both, would also be waiting, keeping their lamps trimmed in anticipation of the late night festivities. And trimmed, of course, we mean with oil and with a wick, and to be ready at all times.
Well, obviously then, as I'm listening to this, this should remind us of Jesus' parable of the 10 virgins, 5 wise and 5 foolish, who were waiting for the bridegroom to come.
Yes, it should. This should help us understand the meaning of the parable told by Jesus in Matthew 25:1-13. In it, the 5 virgins who were prepared for the bridegroom's arrival were rewarded, and the 5 who are not prepared are excluded. And of course, the parable has the clear theme, be prepared for the day of reckoning.
Okay, what happened after the groom came to get his bride?
The 2, accompanied by their wedding party, returned together to the groom's home for the marriage ceremony. Following the public ceremony, the newlyweds entered their bridal chamber to be intimate with each other for the first time. And after this union, the groom came out and announced to the wedding guest, "Our marriage is consummated." Although another source claims that the bridegroom would tell his friend through the door, and the friend would announce it to the assembled guest. On receiving the message, the guest would celebrate a feast for 7 days until the bride and bridegroom emerged from the wedding chamber where they had been in seclusion. This is in that room, you know, that the bridegroom had built attached to his father's home.
Okay.
The bridal chamber. After the groom presented his unveiled bride to the guest, they would join in the feast with friends and family. And of course, there would be a joyous celebration during this feast. The feast would conclude the wedding celebration. And this was the type of feast that Jesus and his disciples attended at Cana.
Okay. Certainly different than what we're accustomed to. What happened after the wedding feast?
After the marriage supper, or feast, the bride and bridegroom would leave the bride would leave the groom's father's house, where the groom had built the wedding chamber, and go to their own home, another home that the groom had either built or had purchased for them to live.
Why do you think Jesus performed this first miracle at the wedding feast of Cana, even though he apparently in the beginning thinks that he would rather not?
He performed his first miracle at the request of his mother, as we just discovered, which shows, as you mentioned, the power of her intercession with her son. Also, he probably did it out of compassion for the bridegroom and bride, who would have been extremely embarrassed if they had run out of wine. Furthermore, no doubt, he wanted to impress his newfound disciples that he was sent by God. These newfound disciples being, of course, Peter and his brother Andrew and John, and perhaps his brother James, although the Bible doesn't tell us whether James is one of the first disciples or not, but we know he had to come in fairly early. And then, of course, there was Philip, and then, of course, his friend Nathaniel. So at least at the wedding of Cana, Jesus had taken five, maybe six, of his first disciples. And of course, a disciple just simply means a follower. Okay. And of course, later on, of course, these five were to be designated, or perhaps six, apostles, one who is sent. And then we know, of course, as we go through the series here, we'll pick up six or seven more of these disciples who become followers of Jesus, but also who become those who are going to be sent, apostles. In other words, making up the 12 apostles. Sure. But anybody who follows Jesus, of course, is a disciple. And there were many, many others being added to Jesus gradually as he goes along here, who become his disciples or his followers. Some of them were very deep followers. Some of them were very close followers. Others fell away. And we're going to find out that for various reasons, especially when we get to John 6, where almost all of his disciples in Galilee were to leave him.
And even Judas had a problem.
Yes.
One of the chosen 12 apostles. Okay. Well, you know, this miracle of Cana is commemorated by so many Catholic brides who usually put a bouquet after the wedding ceremony over at the statue, at the feet of the statue of Mary, to remind them how Mary interceded at the first wedding to bless the couple, and in a special way to ask the blessing of the Blessed Virgin Mary at their wedding feast.
And that reminds me that of another reason that Jesus performed this miracle. It was a sign of God's blessing of the indissolubility of the sacramental marriage bond.
And which is certainly important today when there is so much pressure against marriages to pull them apart, and we face about a 50% divorce rate among Catholics as the normal rate among other people. Well, Ron, it concludes our time. May God bless you, all our listeners, always and in all ways.
Oh, God.